Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, my guest today is Pippa Murray. She's a visionary entrepreneur, trailblazer in the world of nut butter, and the founder of the acclaimed brand Pip and Nut. Founded in 2013, it saw incredible success from the very beginning. And just a couple of years in, her products were winning awards and were launched in Sainsbury's and Selfridges. It's been B Corp certified since 2019 as now the fastest growing nut butter brand in the UK and Ireland. Pippa has also been listed in the Evening Standard's London's Most Influential People and as Startup Entrepreneur of the Year at the NatWest Great British Entrepreneur Awards. So let's look into how Pippa's nut butter went from a hobby to a business venture and how she successfully grew the brand and maybe what she's got planned for the future of Pippa Nut. Pippa Murray, lots of words, sorry about that. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, what a fantastic intro. Thanks so much for having me.
That's great to have you. Now, when I was researching for this interview, I read your story on the Pip and Nut website. And as I read it, I just was overcome by a craving to eat peanut butter. It was really, really weird. The more you just said the words, I needed to eat peanut butter. And I'm not making this up. And now I realise that peanut butter does bring out the obsessive in people. It's one of those things, you know, you can eat a whole pot of peanut butter. Now, it does seem like it's a magical, not, I mean, magical is a crazy idea, but it has a power to drag you in. What is it about peanut butter? Is it sensory perception? Is it about taste, flavour? Is it about the sort of calorific hit you get? What is it that is so powerful about nut butters?
And yeah, you've totally hit the nail on the head with that one, because when I was starting out the business, one of the things that drew me to it and why I thought, you know, I think there's something in this product and brand is that it really does have that addictive quality, and people sit on like both ends of the spectrum. Some people really just don't get on with it and other people absolutely love it. And I do think that really does drive that kind of memorability generally. But why is it? What is it about it? I think it all comes down to the fact that it kind of goes between like being sweet and also quite savory. And it's that kind of slight umaminess that I think you get from it. The fact that we add like a sprinkling of sea salt into our products as well. And I do think that also helps that kind of slight addictive quality. Yeah. And yeah, I think one of the things which I think most people don't really admit to is the fact that more often than not, people eat it straight from the jar, and it's, you know,
onto the fork.
That guilty pleasure that so many people do actually indulge in. And I think it is that kind of, it's quite filling. And I think there is something quite satisfying about that, particularly the amount of people that eat it as a kind of like in between or like a little top me up sort of thing. Yeah. So I think there's something about the sweet savory that really does kind of make you go back for that extra spoonful. Yeah. Certainly, at least me.
Which is not a bad thing also, because nuts obviously have huge amounts of nutrients that we need as well. So, you know, when you grab a peanut butter pot in one hand and a fork rather than a knife, it's not the worst thing in the world. Okay, so the big question really is, why nut butters? Why did you start Pip and Nut? Because let's face it, are you bonkers? There were already lots of big and small peanut butter brands out there. So the challenge that you faced from the start, I would have thought, would be immense. Are you a glutton for punishment, or did you spot a specific gap in the market?
Yeah, definitely saw a gap in this market. And I think it's interesting when you do kind of see it from more of a consumer point of view, you often do have the problem in mind when you are kind of coming to it as a consumer. So it's always a good place to start. It's like put yourself in the mindset of a consumer before you're thinking about any kind of product that you want to launch. But for me, like, about 10 years ago, you know, I was doing lots of marathon running. So I was quite interested in what I was eating, kind of like the nutritional makeup of it. And nut butter actually was one of those things that I would always go to, like post-run. It felt like a treat, but I also knew that it was good for me because it was filled with protein, things like that. But the thing that got me was that nearly every brand that I picked up back then, and in supermarkets specifically, was normally more often than not filled with palm oil. A lot of them were quite processed. Didn't really actually taste of the natural ingredient itself. Very Americanized, and none of it really resonated to kind of more of a natural, healthier shopper like me. And I think as well, like the whole kind of trends that we've been seeing over the last sort of 10 years in sort of the health and wellness space, you know, proteins, this movement away from diet stuff and into kind of real food. And again, was something that I saw within this product that actually it was massively on trend. It was ticking lots of boxes. And there was also a shift away from people perceiving peanut butter as being bad for you, i.e. this is a real treat and actually something that if I put it into my smoothie or onto my porridge, it's actually a real good health addition to my food. So yeah, I guess it was a combination of the fact that I think there was a need to improve the product. There's, you know, take things like palm oil out of it, make it a much more natural product, and make sure it delivers on taste. But also, you know, just a macro trend where it's a growing category, more and more people kind of discovering this product. And actually, you know, that's always a good space to be in when you're launching a business where there's a growth in a category, but also just a general kind of you're riding off the back of wider trends that are happening in society. So I think a lot of those things sort of led me to finding the gap. But yeah, I think my advice, certainly when you're launching a business, is that you don't always need to kind of completely reinvent the wheel. You can sort of tweak something that's already existing in the market. I mean, of course, you can create something completely brand new, but it's just a slightly different job that you're doing then. But there's something great when you can find like a little kind of crack that needs to be filled by a kind of challenger brand and really exploit that.
So I know that I've read your story on the website, but for our listeners, can you just give us a good little version of the gestation and birth of Pip and Nut?
So like I said, I was very much not in this world of food and drink when I started the business. I was working as a theatre producer actually at the time at the Science Museum. So I was working in the creative arts. I was about 24 when I came up with the idea, so I hadn't had a long career. And I was certainly at that stage in my life where I guess I didn't really see the risk in starting a business. For me, it was like, well, I'll give it a go. And if it doesn't work out, I can always get another job. But it really wasn't like, I didn't see the stakes as being particularly high at that particular moment. And for me, you know, I, like I said, was training lots and I thought I saw a gap in this market. And as someone that didn't work in food and drink, I guess I started how I knew how, which was in my kitchen. I bought a blender, bought some ingredients, and I started developing recipes that I thought, you know, someone like me might enjoy. And the way I tested it was going to markets in London. So I think the best idea or kind of bit of advice I had at that really early stage was really to get out and start doing something, even if it's not necessarily the brand that you're aspiring for, but do start putting something out in the world, because I think it can help in terms of making you feel like you've got forward momentum, but also that you can start to kind of work through what it is that you're trying to create. And so I went to London markets and I sold at the weekends. I made, you know, products during the week and sold at the weekends, all while doing sort of a job on the side. And yeah, that was my first experience of kind of talking to consumers and getting that feedback, which was so valuable at that early stage in terms of whether it's recipe developing or really just reaffirming that there was sort of a desire and a kind of a need for my product and brand. And I did that for about probably 4 or 5 months sort of road testing it. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to scale this up. And I sort of stopped markets and then figured out how to actually kind of scale up the product, because I always wanted the brand to be more of a, you know, supermarket brand. I wanted to be a brand that people knew about up and down, you know, the UK and beyond. So I spent about a year trying to figure out how manufacturing works and, you know, what kind of brand I wanted to create and raising some investment.
How did you support yourself for that year?
For that year. So I took a long time before I fully quit my job. So originally I was full time. Then I went down to part time for about a year. And then it was only actually in the last kind of sort of 6 months before I launched the business did I fully quit. And the reason why I quit, which is a long story, which I'll try and tell you fast, is that I won this competition that was being run at the time by a company called Escape the City. And they were running a competition for a startup to basically win 3 months rent free and accommodation and desk space. And but the catch of the whole competition was that the accommodation was actually living in a garden shed. So I pitched it. It was called Escape the Shed, I think it was, the competition. Mm. And I pitched it and there were loads of other startups in the running and I ended up winning it. And I remember the day that I found out that I'd won it and I quit my job that day. I was actually standing on Exhibition Road at the time on the phone to the founder of Escape the City. And yeah, I quit my job and I moved out of my London flat and I moved into this sort of rather makeshift accommodation for 3 months. And that was when I did a crowdfund over the summer. So I spent a couple of months sort of delivering a kind of a crowdfunding campaign on Crowdcube and raised the investment that I needed to kind of get the business launched and never look back since, I guess, from that moment. Yeah. So yeah, I definitely pushed it as far as I could possibly go from a kind of funding it perspective, from my own kind of income and credit cards, you name it. There was a whole mixture of stuff there, but then raised a small amount of capital then, which enabled me to go into full production and start properly trading in January 2015. So I guess from idea to Selfridge's shelves, it took about 2 years to kind of do that full gestational period. So
yeah, which is a long time and a tiny amount of time at the same time, isn't it?
Totally.
It's a kind of extraordinary kind of twist there. So for any potential entrepreneurs out there, is your experience, the advice that you'd be able to give from your experience, to get off your ass, put your thermals on and get out there and start engaging with people?
Absolutely. And I think particularly when you don't work in the sector that you're going into, I think that being active is a really positive thing. I think maybe if you had more experience in the sector, you could probably be maybe faster to market. But I do think sometimes just starting and doing is a great way to get an idea out of your mind and into kind of, I guess, some sort of development in some form or another. So yeah, I think it's a really important stage.
Yeah. And just a little tangential question I've got to ask. What was the most surprising flavour combination you experimented with while you were developing the range of nut butters?
Oh, I did loads.
Even then or now, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We still do loads of really... I mean, we play around all the time.
And you can tell us about something that really didn't work as well as one that did work.
Yeah, I remember once I did try and develop a kind of like chili coriander kind of... I was riffing off a kind of satay, but trying to do it in a nut butter.
That was a bit weird
because yeah, the coriandery taste just couldn't quite balance that. I wouldn't recommend.
That's so annoying because it does make sense, doesn't it?
In theory it should work. Yeah. But yeah, we've done all sorts of different development. Like we tried doing things like PBJ swirls, but that's been quite a hard one to develop. So those haven't always worked out well.
Yeah. I love it. Okay. Now, I think in 2015, the company launched in Selfridges first and then Sainsbury's. I guess that's the sort of second stage of the company, really. Tell us about that experience. You know, how did you land supermarket listings so early? And was it difficult to get those?
Yeah, I think it's definitely one that it is challenging getting onto the supermarket shelves, undeniably. And I think some of the ways that you can try and sort of make it that little bit easier is, I'm a big believer in sort of activating all the kind of premium independent stores first and really starting to prove the test bed of your brand in maybe smaller retailers. So we run Selfridges first and then we started to win Whole Foods and then Ocado came on board and then we won Holland
Barrett.
And is
that bloody hard work?
It is. It's hard. I mean, I'm making it sound really easy, aren't I, when I just sort of casually say it.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, we got Selfridges and then Sainsbury's. It was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, it must be hard.
Sometimes it is quite easy. You speak to the buyer, they love it and they're bought into the concept and it really is that straightforward. Other times you can be knocking on the door every single week, it feels, and getting a no and a pushback. And sometimes actually the worst kind of feedback from retailers is no feedback at all. So sometimes you'll be emailing or wherever, trying to like get in front of the buyer and they just don't respond. And actually that's the hardest part, is trying to kind of figure out, well, how can I get a response? And, you know, that can be a number of different ways, whether that's using some of your contacts to be able to kind of get an intro, or maybe it's about attending an event or a trade event and trying to kind of get in front of the buyer, or it could be inviting them to something that cool that you're doing. I don't know. It could be that you're exhibiting at Taste of London and you have a spare ticket, and maybe that's the way to try and like pull the buyer in to try and get some airtime. And I think trying to get creative.
Bribery is what you're suggesting, isn't it?
Well, you know, I don't like to suggest that there's bribery, but you know, twisting some arms, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I think it is, you've got to get creative. You can't expect buyers just to respond to you just because you think your product and brand is brilliant. But the more you can prove it, so I always found, like, for instance, in Whole Foods, if you can like create an amazing rate of sale and like buzz around your brand in maybe a handful of stores, and then use that to kind of, I guess, demonstrate and provide data points or kind of testimonials, whatever it happens to be, but things that validate that your brand does sell and resonates, is so, so important. Because if you put yourself in the mind of a buyer, you know, a Sainsbury's buyer, a Tesco's buyer, like they're putting a lot of risk involved in putting you on shelf. You've got to perform, like, otherwise their category, their sales are going to go backwards. So really, like, the more you can do it, prove it to them and demonstrate that you're backing the right brand, because, you know, consumers love our product, the more likely you'll get that listing. So yeah, do work on trying to make sure that you think in the mindset of a retailer, not just thinking my brand's great, like, you've got to take it.
Yeah. And does that connection with buyers become a sort of almost emotional connection? You know, are they your mates who've helped you along and you stay in contact, and you know, there's a sort of sense of shared responsibility?
There's definitely, like, particularly in the early days, I could probably name a lot of the buyers that we interacted with, because there was a genuinely, for me, like, when a buyer said, yeah, we'll take it, we'll list it, it was a phenomenal kind of feeling. And they've helped you catapult your brand up and down the UK. Like, there is nothing better than that. So certainly from my point of view, it was quite an emotional experience. And I would often tell the buyers that, because I think if you think about it, a lot of the time they're probably interacting with, you know, a Unilever brand or a P&G, and really it'll probably just be an account manager, you know, that they have a day-to-day like kind of contact with. And so for them to actually feel that they've like helped a young up-and-coming brand get out the door, like, I think it's a brilliant thing. So whether
these
might...
people have to go home and talk to their kids and say, you know, validate themselves in the world as well, don't they? So it's an exciting thing for them to do.
Exactly. And so never be afraid to share your story in that sense, because I do think it kind of is for them, like, actually part of the fun part of their job is that they get to meet sometimes some hopefully inspiring people that are doing something a bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what you've described here is a pretty much a fairy tale upward trajectory. It can't have been that easy. I simply don't believe it. So have there been any particular low points, any bad decisions, infuriating challenges, days when you just thought, F this, I'm going to go pack it all in and go back to the Science Museum?
100%. Like, I think I can name quite I'll name a couple of specifics, but it's funny because I actually quite enjoy the firefighting aspect of it. Sometimes I actually find if it gets too calm and it's almost like, you know, perhaps we've not had a big win in the past few months or whatever it is, I actually find those moments more frustrating, because you're kind of like, you're wanting to push on and you're hungry for it, and it's perhaps moving slower than what you want it to. But certainly there have been like some mic drop moments which haven't been so good that I can lean on. So I do, like, for instance, I remember the day, although I think most people can remember it, but it was particularly poignant for me at the time when Brexit got announced. It was particularly bad because at the time we buy obviously lots of almonds and peanuts internationally from Argentina and California, and we were at the time manufacturing in Europe, so we were very, very exposed from a kind of foreign exchange point of view. And I remember the moment it happened, and then all the pound just plummeted across every currency, and in that moment we lost so much money because we were basically buying our products in euros. So the moment the pound weakened, the more expensive our products got. And at the time, I just had no experience with these kind of macroeconomic things, you know, how they could impact your brand in such a significant way. And I remember just being devastated by the fact that our margins got, you know, obliterated in that one moment, and that I didn't actually have necessarily that immediate control over what to do and how to recover from it. So
you didn't hedge your nuts.
At that time, and I think foolishly, I'd been betting that we would stay in. So I thought it would all work out well, that currency would get stronger as a result, but it went the other way. And I guess within that, you kind of learn to A, never play the market, but B, like, just know that it will, these things happen. I mean, we've had, you know, Brexit, COVID, now inflation. You are riding the wave, and over the more experience you get, the more A, you get a bit more, not in a bad way, but a bit more cautious in some of those kind of those sort of specific things around your supply chain. But also, you know that if your business is resilient and you've built it in a way that's made it more resilient, you will have to just ride it out and know that this will soon pass as well. And yeah, there's also been like product failures, which have been incredibly disappointed. We had a range of almond milks that we launched about 4 years ago now, which I pulled after the first year. And I remember they were an absolutely killer product to try and get out the door. Really hard to develop, spent months sort of back and forth trying to kind of figure out how to develop the products. And for various reasons, they just didn't work. You know, they just didn't get the pull through from consumers, and they just didn't resonate as much. And
which is surprising, I'd say.
It was surprising. And I think lesson learned was that the development of the product was too rushed. They weren't good enough. I'd sold it into the retailers far too early. And we had a launch date confirmed, yet we were still in development, even right up until weeks before our first production. And again, you learn, like, there is a tendency to always want to kind of go at things with pace. And I think that is a great thing. But sometimes...
And presumably your investors are keen as well, because they want the growth, don't
they? Exactly. That you're bricking these like numbers into your forecast. You're going for it. But sometimes it is better to take a tiny bit longer and be really confident with the product that you're going to launch. And I think you really, it's a tension that you've always got to hold, is speed versus quality, and knowing that sometimes giving yourself an extra 6 months to get something, you know, as perfect as you possibly can out the door is normally a good thing, particularly when it comes to product. So yeah, I ended up pulling those products, and I remember just being so disappointed in myself, probably was more the thing that
frustrated. Be devastating to have to do that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Now, you're talking about some complex economics, some complex macroeconomics here as well. And you're clearly immensely clever and rightfully successful, but you're a fluffy theatre producer. I mean, how did, you know, actually being a theatre producer is also a managerial role, and it's a big important thing. But do you ever get a sort of imposter syndrome rush of thinking, hang on, what am I doing being a businesswoman? Or was that in your DNA anyway?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't in my DNA. So I never thought about running a business. I didn't really understand business, I don't think, when I was sort of prior to starting up the company. But I think part of it is about creativity. I am quite a creative person, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're not commercial. And I think if you can try and strike the balance between the two, it actually can be a really strong kind of set of skills that you're kind of bringing to the table. But I think you do need to be, I mean, I mentioned that I run a lot. I am a very competitive person, and I, not necessarily with everyone else, but certainly with myself. And I do think that competitive instinct combined with sort of stubbornness are two of the things which I think I lean quite a lot on. So, you know, when it comes to kind of winning with retailers, I certainly feel like there's a competitive killer instinct that's there. Yeah. And a no is never a no in my mind. So yeah, I mean, yeah, I didn't have big business background, but I think a lot of what you can learn in business, you can learn from other people. And it isn't actually as complicated as I think people make it out to be.
You can learn on the job then, that's quite
You
exciting.
Can learn on the job, and then you, if you get it far enough down the line, that you can employ some really brilliant people. I mean, I have to say, like, all the great stuff that we're doing, it's all down to having a really great team behind me as well, who kind of make ideas that maybe I have into reality. So Yeah, you do mature, but then so does your team. So you're not kind of the only brain in the room.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right. I'd just like to retract my comment about the fluffy theatre producers, because obviously any theatre producer out there, I'm just being obtuse. Yeah, exactly. Now, your branding's really distinctive, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. It's playful, it's wholesome. But you've also just launched a whole product line for dogs. Tell us about all that. I mean, I've used peanut butter in the past when I've been filming with my dog to focus a little bit. Tell us about launching that. Was it always part of the plan?
No. this is one of those things where sometimes if you're too commercial about everything, you probably just won't do anything.
Yes.
And also with, for instance, that range, we've partnered with Butternut Box, which is a brilliant sort of pet food brand. And I guess it's one of those things, like, through our social media, we constantly get tagged in people feeding peanut butter to dogs. It's well known the fact that dogs love peanut butter. And so for us, it was just a fun kind of riff on something that we saw naturally coming through from our customers. And who doesn't love a fluffy animal? I think it's funny. I was speaking to someone that the best advertising apparently are those that contain some sort of picture of a pet or a dog. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, the Andrex puppies work, because people can't help themselves. But I think there was
you melt, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think for us, it was a fun, PR-able kind of product range that we thought this could be a bit of fun, but also hopefully from a kind of brand love and kind of awareness point of view, we could reach consumers in a slightly different way. So it was probably more thinking on the sense of marketing than it was necessarily commercially. But I do think...
Well, how brilliant of you to be brave to launch them, because these things do take a lot of effort, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've got to have fun with your brand. And I think, you know, you can be very serious and always notice the ground and stuff. But with this one, I think we were like, it was sort of pressing the kind of fuck it button a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we should talk about sustainability. It was part of your founding mission to make your products free from palm oil, which is obviously been a big part of the nut butter industry. Now, a lot is talked about sustainability, and especially on this podcast at the moment. What does it mean to Pippa Nut? And I mean, what are the differences with Pippa Nut's approach to sustainability? And how do you avoid, you know, the trap of greenwashing?
Yeah, I mean, sustainability is about continually trying to improve what you've got. And I don't think if you looked at our brand, you'd say that we were perfect through and through. And it's funny, if when you say a brand sustainable, I would say that you know, you've always probably got things that need to be changed and developed. So no brand can be truly sustainable through and through.
It's a journey.
Especially when you're a product, you know, you're going to have an impact regardless of what it is that you're making. So from my point of view, I think the more you can embed kind of the sustainability within your product, the better. So we're focusing a lot on our supply chain because, you know, and agriculture, which is funny. When I started up the business, I would have never have thought that this would be something that I'd spend so much time thinking about. But, you know, the biggest part of our carbon footprint, as an example, about 70% of our total carbon footprint all comes from the agricultural base that we, you know, where we grow our peanuts and almonds.
Yeah.
So really, we spend a lot of time looking at sourcing. So we look at working with the
all that suppliers. Time spent in California must be really tough.
Really difficult, you know, those trips to Buenos Aires, you know, are really tough. But they are really important, though, to try and find suppliers who have a similar mindset to you and are actually embedding more sustainable practices within their overall growing processes. Mm-hmm. So that's a big part of a thread that we're working on. But also, and that helps support our kind of carbon reductions as well. If we can find suppliers who are growing in a better way, that are obviously not using as much carbon in their processes, and that helps us on the path to net zero. Yeah. And we're also a carbon neutral brand. So this year we became carbon neutral, and that we know is one of those things which ultimately the goal is to reduce your overall carbon footprint, but really in the meantime we're looking at kind of sustainable projects that we find exciting that help us also become a carbon neutral brand by offsetting our carbon. So yeah, I think there's lots of different things that you can thread through it, but I think for me it's about trying to look at your products and where can you have the most impact, and then second to that, what also do consumers care about as well? What are they looking for you? So packaging is also a big thing in the mind of a consumer. How can you reduce the amount of packaging you're using, or make it more reusable, or use more recycled material within it? So all of those things are, I guess, what sustainability means to Pip and that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so my last question really is, we have a lot of people who listen to this podcast who are thinking about careers in food or are just launching themselves into the food world. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get some advice from you. And I wonder how easy that is to give, because you've been Startup Entrepreneur of the Year. These questions must be thrown at you quite a lot. But it sounds very much that your story is a very personal one about a passion that you had, about something you wanted to do. You can't invent those from nothing, can you? You've got to have that burning inside you to be able to follow it up. Are there key traits that you can, that make a good entrepreneur, do you think? Or do you just need to have something burning inside?
I do think you need to make sure whatever it is that you're doing, you genuinely love, because you're going to be sitting with it, that brand and product, indefinitely. Like, so yeah, you can't
it's just
be
your
just
wallpaper
like
and your furniture and everything, isn't it, for you?
Exactly. You've got to love it. You really do. Got to love the industry that you're working in. But I do think there are traits. I said it earlier, but I do think resilience is a really, really important thing that, you know, you need a high kind of resilience threshold and a relatively high risk threshold as well, because you've got to be able to sit in uncomfortable situations and ride it out and not let it kind of completely tarnish your whole life. So I think having that kind of resilience and the ability to always see, perhaps naively, the positive things, I think helps, because otherwise I think you wouldn't take the risks that you would want to take. So I think that for me is a key thing. And the second kind of thing that I think is important when it comes to being an entrepreneur is that I think anyone can be an entrepreneur. I don't think it's something that's just for the few. I think what you've just got to make sure is just that you are being active and doing and enjoy the process of learning something new and being uncomfortable, not knowing everything. And I think actually that's the bit that I always enjoy the most, is when we're doing something that we've never done before. And actually your job is to kind of solve the problems and figure it out and learn a whole new set of language or, you know, skills that you didn't necessarily have before. And if you're kind of a hungry learner, I do think that's a great trait to have as an entrepreneur, because you're more often than not, like, you might know part of it, but you're going to be having to do the whole thing when it comes to the business. So you've got to get comfortable kind of being a novice and trying to get to be an expert.
Blimey, it's so easily said. And yet there's a whole world of pain inside there. Pip, thank you so, so much for talking to us. I'm sure that Pip and Nat is going to go from strength to strength. And I need to get some of your butter from a dog as well. So my best of luck to you. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.